Small businesses are the cornerstones of our local communities, and small business owners are hardworking and passionate people who are chasing down their ambitions while there's a lot on the line. So, let Verizon champion your small business dreams. Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon, well, they've got you back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business.
So why do you want to learn a new language?
I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
From the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and beaming out across all of space and time, this is Star Talk, where science and pop culture collide. Welcome to the Hall of the Universe. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. You're a personal astrophysicist. Tonight, we're featuring my interview with actor and geek icon, Jeff Goldblum. We talked about everything from bringing back dinosaurs to fighting evil aliens. So let's do this. My co-host tonight is comedian Chuck Nice.
Hey, hey.
Chuck in the house. Tweeting a Chuck Nice comic.
Thank you, sir, yes.
And also joining us tonight is a colleague of mine at the museum, paleontologist Ross McPhee. Ross!
Ross!
Oh!
Boom! Thank you.
You're curator of mammals right here at the American Museum of Natural History, and you travel the world digging up fossils to learn about extinct animals. Is that character, is that like what your business card says?
It should.
Okay.
It should. That'd be a good line.
Yeah, very good. So thanks for joining us on Star Talk. We're featuring my interview with geek actor Jeff Goldblum. And he plays scientists with a swagger, right? From the blockbuster film Independence Day and, of course, in Jurassic Park. Mm. So I asked him how his sort of iconic scientist character in Jurassic Park came to be. Let's check it out.
Well, it was beautifully scripted. You know, I'm sure you read Michael Crichton's book.
Yeah,
I'll bet, you know. And then Steven Spielberg, and they'd written a beautiful script. So it was really that character. But I did try to influence. I did have this idea that, you know, I could hip it up a little.
Well, right, because there's swagger, you know.
I tried.
Swagger isn't always in the script.
Yeah.
You know,
it wasn't. Well, it was maybe a little bit that Richard Attenborough has that line, you know, I bring a scientist, you bring a rock star.
Oh, yeah.
So somebody calls me a rock star. So I thought, hey, I have license to shop for a jacket that I think will be right. Mm-hmm. I kind of had lobbied for a few articles of clothing.
What year was that? That was
93.
Okay. That may have been the first ever badass geek person portrayed in movies.
Hey. I mean, think about that.
Well,
there you are, brilliant mathematician.
Yeah.
You're glib, you're clever, you've got philosophical points, you're good looking, and you got a little kind of, you got presence. This was breaking stereotypes, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And it's important, I'm sure you have feelings about this. I'm passionate that smart people not be undervalued.
Yeah, smart people have feelings too, and they have attitudes and things that are never, not previously ever explored.
Right, and their contribution of intelligence is in itself sexy and valuable and...
good point. Intelligence as a point of sexiness.
Yeah, you're using geeky. I see now, using geeky to kind of agree with the conventional thinking of geeky, smart is geeky. I don't call a smart person a geek. You know, geek is originally the term is usually it originally comes from circus life. You know, geeks were the people who bit for entertainment bit heads off of live chickens.
I didn't know that.
I think that's where it comes from, and then it became you know a smart person. But you know, the next logical step is the movie Idiocracy.
Yeah.
Where anybody who can read a little bit is called, oh, you're a sissy or you're a geek. You know, that's where that goes.
Yeah.
No.
It's a future where there's the dumbing down of the population of the world.
We see where that goes and could go further. No, we must uphold and champion, as you do better than I do, intelligence as beautiful, sexy, powerful, virile.
Chuck, did he pull this off in the movie?
I don't know, man. I think he's super sexy. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Did you notice his reaction though when you said he was sexy?
I said good looking.
You said and he was like.
All right. So Ross.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to Jurassic Park when it came out?
Implausible, but great.
Not impossible.
Oh, well, you want to make a fine distinction. You're not going to bring dinosaurs back with ancient DNA.
You're such but a spoil so sport.
So what? The show as science fiction, emphasis on fiction, was fantastic. And in fact, science, in a real sense, did play a role. Things were explained. It wasn't just assumed.
Oh, right. There was that descriptive section where they talk about evolution and embryos and this sort of thing. So that had some academic value.
Yeah, I think so.
No, you don't, Ross.
I know.
I don't know why you
said that.
Exactly.
You just
let us know exactly how you really felt.
Here's what I liked about Jeff Goldblum. He put the badass in glasses. Thank you.
That's called bad glass.
So professional scientists have the reputation that they can't talk to the public, right? You've got this guy,
rock star.
Yeah. But I don't think that's true, and I think it's increasingly true that we're very interested in talking to the public. And whether that comes through from interviews like this that we're going to have or through movies, there's an interest, there's practically even a need for people to be better informed about science. It's just interesting. And that's the point.
So how about the part where they're just dusting a fossil and the fossil just pops out of the ground?
It can happen.
Really? Because I've seen videos of you guys. That's a hard thing, getting a fossil out of the ground.
It can be. It really depends. So if you're talking Cretaceous dinosaurs, it's mostly going to be rock. Jackhammers are the sorts of things that you need most of the time. But I deal with much more recently extinct organisms. And
like the ones from the movie The Ice Age, right?
Yeah. perhaps not cartoon characters. I was thinking more 10,000 BC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Not as much fun as the little squirrel with the nut, but that's okay.
You had saber-toothed tigers then, didn't you? No?
10,000 years ago, we certainly did.
Yeah, okay.
There are many species and other things that have disappeared.
We were coming out of the Ice Age. So I just arrived at this museum when Jurassic Park came out. So I only got sort of bits of the mood and emotion. Did we see institutionally a rise in public interest towards dinosaurs after Jurassic Park came out?
Absolutely. You know, up until that time, mammals sort of ruled in paleontology. Dinosaurs were seen as kind of an evolutionary dead end. But with Jurassic Park and the animations showing that dinosaurs were, in some cases, extremely athletic, able to move around at great speed and things like that, bite lawyers, this really changed things.
So since then, what are some big discoveries in the last 20 years, let's say?
For things that I'm working on, the biggest change, I guess, would be moving not away from bones, but toward genetics, so that we're able to get ancient DNA from things that are not too old and do increasingly a lot with them. We're learning a heck of a lot about species that are no longer with us as to basic physiological processes and things of this nature that we never would have guessed we could get.
Just from bones?
From bones. There'd be no way.
So in Jurassic Park 1, there's the now famous line uttered by Jeff Goldblum, which is, you scientists are so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop and think if they should. So let's start out with Jeff's reaction to the ethical implications of that line. Check it out.
It's very interesting. I want to talk to you about that and canvas your feeling, because I'm interested in seeing what I can contribute to that conversation.
It would be nice, because you started it.
Right.
Right.
So maybe you can help me. Maybe before I leave here, mm-hmm. you can even enhance my thinking about it. So here's what my current thinking is that, well, I'll just tell you what's happened in this next version that's coming out without ruining anything. We talk about some issues that came up in the one 25 years ago. I talk again about science and ethics. And
issues. I like that. How polite.
Right.
Dinosaurs eating people. We call these issues.
Well, that's true. But especially these issues that I am thinking about and my character talks about, which is ethics around science mm-hmm. and all that. That line in the one 20 years ago, maybe now we want to tweak it a little bit where there's no ambiguity in what we're saying, which is that we shouldn't deprecate science at all. We shouldn't indict science at all. And we tweaked my little speech, so I say something about, whether it's still in the movie, glorious science. I say something about the wonderful investigative curiosity and the continuum of science. The scientific approach is a wonderful thing, but it's the exploitation and the non-ethical use of it for profit, screwy entertainment, cheap entertainment, heaven forbid, militarism, et cetera, nationalism, you know, et cetera, that must be fought with every breath in our body, something like that.
All of those thoughts went through my head when I heard you utter that line 20 years ago.
Really?
Yes.
Except one could think,
no, I was saying,
hey, scientists, yeah, these scientists, these Frankenstein, Dr. Frankensteins, they got to be, you got to watch those guys.
Yeah, I said to myself, he's blaming scientists.
Oh, good.
And
I don't want to do now, right?
And I said, scientists don't actually have the power that you think. Their actual power comes from governments and legislations and funding sources that have priorities that go beyond what a scientist does in the lab. And then they decide how they want to use it. But I said, all right, it's a movie. We got to let the line go.
Yeah, but
that's
now...
That's what I said to myself at the time.
Yes. See if you like... I don't know if you've seen it yet, but see if you like this new one where I think we're clearer and we tweak
okay.
that. So
right.
Don't blame science.
Ross, how do you feel about the urge of some to blame science for the fallout of the applications of science in the world?
Here's how I feel about it. It's yin-yang. You want progress? Progress comes from science. Can it be misused? Of course it can. And there is nothing that an individual can do except be well-informed on what the issues are. So when this kind of misuse does come up, like in weaponization of space, that people speak out against it, that they're an informed electorate.
I'm blaming scientists.
Why?
Well, you can do that.
Yeah, that's all I know.
But it's like this young man said, they're powerless. Their products are used by people who do have power.
So do you have issues with Goldblum movies for this reason?
No. I just love the fact that he called getting eaten by dinosaurs issues.
So Ross, in your field, do you have controversial ethical issues going on right now? And I think specifically about, because you said now it's a genetic analysis, not just what bones fit together in a puzzle. So how about cloning, gene editing, that sort of thing?
here's the idea, that we can now go into the genome, to the genetic material of a species, and alter it in a way that is favorable to us, or perhaps favorable to the organism. It depends on what the problem is. So in a way, you're playing God. Now, that brings up all kinds of issues about what the heck you think you're doing. My view of it is, nature by itself is not subject to human ethics. It's not that there's good and that there's bad. It's just the way
it just is.
But to the degree that we interfere with nature, which is inevitable given the numbers of us on the planet, you have to ask the question, where do you want to stop? And where I personally want us to stop is to intervene as little as possible in the parts of the planet where we haven't made a complete screw-up. So that includes parts of the ocean. It also includes parts of the continents where humans are not as ubiquitous as they are in most other places. Make those sanctuaries. Make them safe. Keep us out.
No humans allowed.
No humans allowed.
That's beautiful. Ross. Well, up next, we discuss the possibility of bringing dinosaurs back to life when Star Talk returns.
Unlocking the secrets of your world and everything orbiting around it. This is StarTalk.
Spring Black Friday savings are happening now at the Home Depot, and also at your front door. Get spring savings delivered to you with free delivery on over 2 million items. Everything you need for spring cleaning, patio decorating, and front yard gardening sent right to you. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Spring your way with Spring Black Friday savings only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
Star Talk from the American Museum of Natural History. And we're featuring my interview with actor, geek icon, Jeff Goldblum, talking about his role as a scientist in the Jurassic Park movies. And I asked about the idea of bringing extinct animals back to life. Check it out. De-extinction, would you bring back T-Rex, the dodo bird, or none of the above?
I think the world has to work for everyone.
Very important.
I think that's a good credo.
Very important.
The world should work forever. Let's make a world that works for everyone, whatever works means. And I think we know what that means. Nothing mysterious about that. Works for everyone. So
in thinking just about the, and this is not to poo-poo my successful franchise, participation in the successful franchise, but no. Well, my character says, this is a bad idea. It's a bad idea. Evolution had its say. Darwin is a hero of mine. Evolution had its say, and the dinosaurs went out from the universe.
That's their shakes.
A story that the universe told, and now it's our turn, and like that. And yes, especially, you want to bring it back for, because you want to make an amusement park? You want to sell some tickets? Because, you know, I would say no. I would say no about that, certainly. Now, if it's just pure knowledge, like splitting the atom, is there something about resurrecting? That means we could bring back everybody who's ever died, I guess, or every species that's ever been. We'd have to talk about that. But before we get into dinosaurs, aren't all the species, not only the beautiful human species, but every other species, aren't they infinitely mysterious and magical and worthy of our respect and awe and protection? Elephants, you know what we're doing with elephants, that are, if we're just talking about, hey, we like dinosaurs because they're big, so we have big creatures here and in the oceans and all the creatures there. Shouldn't we tend to those first and make sure that we protect them, not put them in zoos, not make money off of them, but just make sure we all, that it works for everybody.
And we all get along.
That would be my moral instinct. I'm no doctor.
Well, you played one on
TV. I play one on TV.
Very nice. Very nice.
Russ, you specialize in this, among your multiple specialties that I know of. One of them is extinction and de-extinction. So tell me how de-extinction would work.
Very simply, de-extinction is the idea of bringing back species, populations that are no longer with us because they've disappeared. So think woolly mammoths. We've been talking about woolly mammoths as a good example. The last of them died out on continents about 10,000 years ago. There were remnant populations on islands until about 4,000 years ago, but they're gone. And the question, accordingly, is, were we responsible? A lot of people think so. So do we owe it to woolly mammoths to the degree that we can bring them back to bring them back?
Because we were accountable. Whereas we're not accountable for the death of T-Rex, so let them stay dead.
That's right. Well, it goes beyond that.
That's right. You said that. That's right.
It goes beyond that because ancient DNA, which is the building blocks that you'd have to use for the experiments to bring the animals back, has a life of no more than a million years. So you're not going to go back 66 plus million years and bring back the dinosaurs. That was always the fundamental problem with Jurassic Park.
Okay, so let's just imagine. If we could bring back T-Rex, should we?
What's it going to do? What's its ecosystem function? It's going to eat lawyers. Okay. What else is it going to do? And the answer is nothing. It has no place.
You're right. It'll be in a zoo.
It has no... Yes, it'll exactly. Be in a zoo. So it's going to be an exhibit, like we have here at the American Museum, except everything here is dead and stuffed, which is a difference.
But you might consider bringing, if we are entirely responsible, our troglodyte ancestors are responsible for the extinction of the woolly mammoth. You feel some guilt there, I guess.
Well, that's the ethical question.
I don't think we should bring it back because, here, woolly mammoth, they were thriving during the Ice Age. Right. And we're going to bring it back just in time for global warming. What the hell is that about?
They will be so uncomfortable. My God, it's hot. What have you done with the place?
I know, yeah, right. So, Chuck, would you bring back animals, Chuck?
I would bring back animals, but quite frankly, I like food. And so, as a foodie, I would only bring back those that are delicious.
Oh, well, how would you know what was delicious?
I don't know. That is why I have a little game that I would like to show you right now.
Okay.
Where Ross will tell me if these animals are delicious.
Are they tasty?
Are they tasty? Could we bring it back?
To eat it.
My first submission would be the Cryptodon. All right. First of all, I will tell you...
Wait, is that a real... Ross, is that real?
Is that real?
Yes, it is. It's a gigantic armadillo that lived in South America. Some
how
also
big?
Lived in North
how
America. Big? Some of them were upwards of 2,000 kilograms. Mm-hmm. So 4,000 pounds.
4,000 pounds.
So a ton.
Yes, these are big armadillos.
Yes, right.
Now, what would it be like for Chuck? I think it would be a lot like eating a tennis racket, frankly.
Damn it.
If you just look at the beast, you can see that it's very heavily armored.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's bone sort of everywhere.
Right.
Like a little tank.
Right.
And in order to support that mass,
it needs really tough tissue.
Big bones.
Really tough, yes.
And ooh, tough
that's
tissue.
That's good deduction.
So it's not good. It's not good to eat.
Good,
so
good
there you go. So I don't
but could we bring it back?
The last of them died out about 10,000 years ago. It's within reach of ancient DNA.
So that's a yes.
That's a yes as to could we? And then we go Jeff Goldblum to say should we?
Ooh.
I don't know. An animal that looks like Epcot Center, I think I want to bring it back.
That's good.
All right, here's my next one. Megatherium.
Okay, Megatherium.
Ooh. Megatherium.
This is now getting very serious in body size. This could be upward of 4,000 kilograms. So we're talking the size of the largest elephants that are around today.
Wow.
What I need to say is that this is a sloth. You know about tree sloths, right? Those are the only sloths that are still with us. They come in at 5 kilograms, so 11 pounds. This guy, a couple of orders of magnitude larger.
Jeez.
I think more tennis racket. More than anything else, but
once again, doesn't taste good.
Well,
yeah,
I don't know.
But easy to catch is a sloth.
So can we bring it back?
It's the same as the Glyptodon. Died out 10,000 years ago. There's ancient DNA. I've worked on its ancient DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It's there to work on.
It's within reach. Right on.
The question more
but don't worry, Megatherium, we're gonna take our time. Bringing you back. Here's the last one.
Last one,
And we talked on it. We touched on it.
Woolly.
Should we? First of all, how would a woolly taste? And I mean, if we were part of its extinction, I can only hope that we were eating it.
Well, you know, there are stories. When these carcasses appear in places like Siberia, as they do from time to time.
When they emerge from a receding glacier or something?
Yeah, where they melt out of riverbanks. Mm-hmm. That's the commonest way. There are stories of people, and dogs in particular, of having had a steak or two. Now, I personally have never done that, nor would I want to. I mean, think about it. This is something that's been dead 10,000 years. This is the worst road pizza you can imagine.
Well, my buddy Bill Nye, the science guy, he has some thoughts on Jurassic Park-style de-extinction. Let's check it out.
We're all fascinated with dinosaurs. That's part of why the movie Jurassic Park was such a hit. It's a classic and classic science fiction. Now keep in mind that science is not inherently good or bad, it's a process. But let's face it, in science fiction movies, we want to see scientists doing something dangerous. And those scientists are usually evil. But what if we could really do that Jurassic Park DNA thing? And bring back an extinct species to de-extinct some extraordinary animal. Well, I guarantee you, we'd learn a lot about biology. We'd learn a lot about evolution and ourselves. But is it a good idea? What if we accidentally produced a population of vicious predators who would think nothing of biting your head off and chewing you up and spitting you out? Now, that really would be scary. Fortunately, that technology is a long way off.
So up next in my interview with Jeff Goldblum, we discuss the butterfly effect when Star Talk returns.
This is Star Talk.
Welcome back to Star Talk from the American Museum of Natural History right here in New York City. We're featuring my interview with actor Jeff Goldblum. And I asked about his character in Jurassic Park, where he evokes the concept of chaos theory. Let's check it out. Did you have to do any homework to justify, as an actor, using the word chaos in a sentence?
Oh, you know, chaos itself or chaos theory.
Chaos theory,
that
yeah.
I was talking about in that movie. You know, I did my due diligence. I'm nothing if not conscientious.
That's good.
I'm a good worker. My dad was a work ethic person. Mm-hmm. He was a doctor. I read that book and whatever else I could get my hands on in the time I had and tracked down a couple of pioneering high class, I was told, practitioners,
good.
Devotees.
Because you delivered the line with some
with some panache.
Well, I knew enough to pretend like I can't. You know, when you play these parts, you realize, hey, I could never. I'm not a brain surgeon. Right. These people have devoted. I'm not an astrophysicist, but I can be curious, and I do enough in the time from the time I get the part to try do my best at pretending well, so that I can credibly, you know, say whatever I say.
I think you pulled it off.
Well,
and chaos. What I think in modern times, it's been the word has less currency today than it did. You know, a couple of decades ago, unfortunately, because it's still a force to be reckoned with.
Is it? Is it?
In the world.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. Chaos theory is you can model a system that's very complex. You put in the initial conditions and watch it go.
Uh-huh.
And it makes a cloud, or in the case of weather, you can make wind patterns.
And the butterfly effect, of
course. Yeah, that's what it comes down to, right? And so then you say, okay, let me change these initial conditions by the tiniest amount.
Yes.
And see if I can change the result by a little bit. So you change by a tiniest amount. You get a completely different result.
Can you imagine us in our lives when we say, hey, should I make this decision? Should I have that impossible
burger now? The contingencies of branch points in our lives. So
yes.
I guess that's a kind of a chaotic analog. You don't know how different your life would be from that one little change.
If you've meant one little
thing. One little thing. Okay, joining us to help make sense of chaos in chaos theory is economist Raphael Chap. Welcome. You're a faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, and you teach a course called Chaos Theory, Complexity, Emergence, and Chaos.
Right.
So how do you explain chaos theory to your students?
Right. So in ordinary speech, chaos means disorder, lack of rules, lack of order. But chaos theory is a bit more subtle, and it gives us a new understanding of dynamical deterministic systems. Dynamical means you have variables, they change over time. Deterministic means if you know everything about the state of the system, the equations at any time, the equations unambiguously tell you what happens next, and only one thing can happen. So there's no room for randomness. And yet, these systems can sometimes behave in ways that appear to be random and unpredictable. Some examples of chaotic motion, the drip of water in a faucet, the oscillation of a double rod pendulum, the motion of a moon of Saturn called Hyperion. It's a little rock that just moves erratically. But also climate, weather.
So these are very diverse manifestations of chaos theory in our lives and in the world.
Indeed. You can find it in many places.
And you teach economics.
Correct.
So we don't want to hear that there's chaos in economics. We don't want to know that.
Please, my 401k is tentative as it is.
So tell me about the butterfly effect.
So the sensitivity to initial conditions in popular terms, that's called the butterfly effect. That's really what has captured our imagination, and it comes from the title of a paper by a gentleman named Edward Lorenz, who presented this paper at a conference in the early 70s. And the title was, Does the Flap of a Butterfly Wing in Brazil Set Off a Tornado in Texas? But the idea that's captured here is really the fact that a very seemingly inconsequential event, right, a butterfly with the wing, can have a really huge impact in another side of the world. It's very poetic. That's the butterfly effect.
Mm. Exactly, which is why I hate butterflies. Hate them. They're nothing but tiny little colorful bats.
So Ross, does chaos play a role in extinction? Could there be some series of events that just go out of control and gone as a species?
Well, I don't think that it's necessarily as ordered as
chaos.
As Raphael was just talking about, but it could be similar in some ways. So let's go back to dinosaur days, since that's what we've been talking about. About 75% of everything living at the time disappeared. But that means 25% survived.
You're talking about the 65 million years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who is that 25%? It's all over the place. So, for example, crocodiles survived, whereas a lot of other groups that are reptiles, including everything except birds, disappeared. Now, why should that be the case? Why should everything that's sort of on the wrong side of the fence or the wrong side of the railway tracks, in the case of dinosaurs, have disappeared? You had dinosaurs by the end of the Cretaceous 66 million years ago that were the size of chickens, as well as the Tyrannosaurus. So size is not the issue. There was something going on there physiologically, so they didn't make it, but birds did. And there were feathered dinosaurs that were not avian. My point is that people like me spend a lot of time trying to sort out logically why these things disappeared. And maybe the logic is not there, that these catastrophic effects were so general that in some cases you just had bad luck, and in other cases you made it for similar reasons that you had good luck, but it had nothing to do with anything else.
I'm sure the dinosaurs are very happy to hear that right now. Sorry, guys, you just had bad luck.
So, Raphael, people generally think of chaos as something bad. Mm. Like you said right earlier, we want to avoid chaos in our daily lives. But is there a way to think of chaos as something good?
I think the reason that chaos is bad, we tend to think of that as something bad, is because order gives us a sense of security, safety, and there's an old philosophical idea of chaos. And for the Greeks, it was this state of the world before creation. So it was a real placeholder for the mystery of the universe. Everything that makes us uncomfortable, we put that label on it. In terms of our daily lives, chaos is everywhere. In simple systems, it doesn't have to be a lot of variables. And it can also... it can be found everywhere. So you turn on your faucet in your bathroom, the water, that's chaotic. In your bathtub, it's chaotic. In your kitchen, you whisk some egg whites, that's chaotic. You take some dough, you fold it and stretch it, that's chaotic. Your brain, your brain waves.
Believe me. I'm so with you.
Your heart rate. If it becomes chaotic, you're in trouble. You have a heart attack.
Okay, so what you're saying is we are living with chaos on the assumption that it's bad, but in fact it's a fundamental dimension of life itself.
Well, there's the question of the implication of the butterfly effect in our daily lives, in our decisions.
Going forward, yeah.
You know, one interpretation could be if the long-term consequences can be predicted, it doesn't really matter what I do. So, like, I can do whatever. Or you could think about it in terms of, seemingly inconsequential things that I do in ordinary life can actually change the world, right? And they can matter a great deal. They can be that bifurcation of the world into a different future. So that puts a lot of pressure on us, right? It can be nerve-wracking and maybe paralyzing.
I think it's good pressure. It's a pressure that you ought to be able to confront in life. Otherwise, you're a victim of your future rather than a master of it.
Right.
Well, Raphael, thank you for joining us on Star Talk tonight.
Thank you so much.
Up next in my interview with Jeff Goldblum, we discuss how to deal with evil aliens invading Earth when Star Talk returns.
Spring Black Friday savings are happening now at the Home Depot and also at your front door. Get spring savings delivered to you with free delivery on over 2 million items. Everything you need for spring cleaning, patio decorating, and front yard gardening sent right to you. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Spring your way with Spring Black Friday savings only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Bringing space and science down to Earth. You're listening to Star Talk.
We're back on Star Talk, featuring my interview with actor Jeff Goldblum. And Jeff plays a scientist in the classic film Independence Day, where evil aliens come to exterminate humans. And I ask if he thinks we should be prepared to fight aliens the way they did in the movie. Let's check it out.
We must learn how to resolve differences non-violently. And even though the universe may be a violent place and a hostile place, we shouldn't, like Independence Day, figure out how to arm ourselves and survive against the hostile universe. We should revolve as a species, as a peaceful species.
However, what will happen before the Martians come?
Yes.
Let me double check when the Martians are coming. What will happen before the Martians come is that an asteroid will come.
Right,
and
right.
We will need the power, the wisdom, the energy, the financing to deflect the asteroid, lest we go extinct, as did the dinosaurs.
So that's my question. So when they're developing the bomb, maybe they didn't think about it then, but there is a use. You think you could, are you saying that with a nuclear weapon, you could...
There are multiple ways you can... if you want to destroy the thing in space, yes, a nuclear weapon is our best understanding of how to do that. But if you want to have it not hit us, you don't need to destroy it. You just deflect it.
Okay, but with new this technology.
No, there's kindler, gentler ways to. You just sort of shove it a little.
Amazing.
It doesn't take much, and if you do it early enough, that gentle push can completely miss Earth.
So interesting.
Joining us to discuss defending Earth from asteroids is planetary astronomer Kelly Fast. Kelly, welcome. Thanks for joining us. You're a program manager in the Planetary Defense Coordination Office at NASA headquarters. That sounds really badass. You're protecting Earth. Somebody's got to do it. It's a tough job.
But somebody's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it. So what is NASA doing to defend the planet? And against what? Against asteroids or anything else?
Well, against near-Earth asteroids, the one that end up in our neighborhood. Like you mentioned, you want to do something early, and so the first step in doing that is to find them before they find us. And so NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office supports efforts that survey the skies, looking for near-Earth asteroids, cataloging them, but then also calculating their orbits to figure out where they're going to be in the future. I mean, as you know, two bodies in the same space at the same time is not good. That's bad. And then also looking at mitigation possibilities, should it become necessary to get them before they get us?
Well, you sound confident because you're like, okay, but we have funding to detect them, but not funding to deflect them, correct?
Well, it's actually, there are studies.
That's a no.
Yeah.
That's a no?
That
was a no.
Very much a no.
No, that's not. Actually, the DART mission is a NASA mission in development.
DART.
DART. Mm-hmm. It stands for the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. And it is in development to demonstrate a mitigation technique so that should it become necessary to do it one of these days, we'll at least have looked at how that technique performs. And in this case, it would be the kinetic impact technique. I mean, you had mentioned, you know, if you could do this early, if you find them and you know well ahead of time, you don't have to deflect it a whole lot in order for it to miss Earth in the future. And
so how likely are we to detect it, a bad asteroid early enough?
Well, that's the thing. The larger near-Earth asteroids, 1 kilometer and larger in size, the ones that would have global consequences.
Right.
The nice thing is they're the low-hanging fruit. There are fewer of them, they're larger, they're easier to find, and we have a better handle on that population. But it's the...
For once, it's worked in our favor.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, the big bad ones are easy to detect, yeah.
But as you get smaller and smaller, there are more and more of them, and it's harder and harder to find them. And so when you're talking about a size range now that 140 meters and larger, let's say, that could have regional impact should it hit Earth, that population is estimated to be more like 25,000. And after 20 years of surveying the skies, even though capabilities have gotten better with telescopes and doing this from the ground, there still are about two-thirds of that population left to be found. And so that's the thing, you know, being concerned about what we have yet to find, so that at least there are some things in the toolbox, you know, should this become an issue.
Ross, you study extinction. And so there are multiple extinction episodes, but five major ones,
The
big mass extinction. How many of those are implicate asteroids as a source?
Well, it's interesting. When it was first proposed with evidence in the early 1980s, people started thinking, okay, it wasn't just the dinosaurs. It was the same sort of thing again and again. You'd have these extraterrestrial visitors that blew the place up. But then...
You don't mean aliens, you mean asteroids.
In this case.
Yes.
But it didn't work out that way. So you have two problems. You've got big extinctions without any correlated or obvious impactor anywhere. And you've also got impactors, some of which must have been very large in size, that didn't do anything.
Well, you have a smoking gun with no damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's awkward.
That's very awkward. Yeah. So now the thinking is going to Earth processes, particularly the release of tremendous amounts of lava, tremendous amounts of magma.
Supervolcanoes,
along with all the noxious gases. So you get widespread poisoning of both the air and the sea. And that's the thing that has driven at least some...
Earth's trying to kill us.
Well...
NASA can't help that. Well, Independence Day, it was aliens that were coming to destroy the Earth. And Jeff Goldblum and I discussed the idea of contacting aliens that could be hostile. So let's check it out. You don't give strangers in the street your email address, much less the return address to Earth to aliens.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
No, it's not. There's no but wait a minute to that sentence.
Well,
that's a totally good sentence.
That's
requires
true.
No modification.
Well, but sir, doctor, let me see.
Okay.
Yes, that's what we do, and I agree.
You don't do that. They're your own species.
I'm not going to tell him my address.
They're your own species.
That's true.
Okay.
But we're a funny species, and that's interspecies, I don't know, especially the aspiration to make contact.
It's huge.
Come on. Yes, can't we forgo that paranoia, which we know on Earth between ourselves is justified?
Well, it's justified because there's someone who you don't know who could do harm to you.
Yeah, but if they wanted to do harm, they could do so much harm that we can't do what we did in Independence Day. I would not build up our nuclear forces, because who knows what. So I would not use it as a reason to weaponize and to further, fund our weaponry. No, I think we have to err on the side of, hey, here we are. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, you're an expert. I would say, if I was going to make the decision, if it was up to me, I'd say, yeah, here we are. Here we are. Here's our address. Here's everything about us. Here's all our diseases. Here's my medical records. Here's my tax records. Whatever you want to know.
Kelly, what does NASA's Planetary Defense think about the several occasions, and surely more to come, where we beam the return address of Earth out into space with the attempt to contact possibly hostile aliens? And we know they're hostile because every movie except Spielberg's E.T. has them sucking our brains out.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I've seen Independence Day, and I've seen enough science fiction movies to know that it's a really bad idea.
Well, you agree it's a bad idea.
I agree it's a bad idea, but at least as far as NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office is concerned, we're concerned about the asteroids, about the hard stuff, and not about the squishy stuff with tentacles. That's somebody else's job.
Well, up next in my interview with Jeff Goldblum, we discuss cultivating a curious mind. And Jeff expressed deep passion and interest in science and learning in our conversation. And I asked him where that curiosity began. Check it out. As an academic and as a scientist, I deeply respect curious minds. Where does that come from? Where does it come from?
I'd be remiss when I'm with somebody like you, who would I be? Shame on me if I didn't start to bubble with a little curiosity.
Okay.
You're a fountain. When you're right near the fountain, don't you get a little thirsty?
Fountain of curiosity.
Well, there you go. So my curiosity, well, I think it's in us if we don't snip it off and undermine it and sabotage it.
So it just never left you?
Something like that, yes. I see my kids. I got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, two boys.
Whoa.
Well, it must be in us. Yeah. They're not so special, I don't think. But boy, they go from one.
Right. Until they're three, half their curiosity would kill them. So it's up to you to prevent them from checking out the edge of the cliff.
That's our main job, to keep them safe.
And then when they're five, six, seven, then they can be on their own with reduced risk of them having their curiosity kill themselves. Many parents over-constrain the curiosity.
Over-constrain their curiosity for safety reasons.
For safety, yeah. They think something that we're just... Or for they don't want to break something. When the child is playing with a plate, don't touch that, you might break it. Maybe there's something to be learned if it breaks. It makes a sound, something is hard, but then it's in a million pieces, the pieces can cut you. There's knowledge there.
Somebody told me that we adhere to this thing called RIE, R-I-E, which is, yes, don't you teach them.
Right.
They're doing physics, they're doing something.
When let them do it.
They're doing something you don't even understand.
More free-range children.
All of that, yes. But after that, why do I show them so that they can really... Well, I would show them. What I would show them is the entire series of Cosmos. I would show them you before I showed them any other so-called wisdom literature or other. I'd say, this is where you are. This is who you are, and this is what we know about...
Our place in the universe.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Ross, we have a mildly privileged position being... experts in two fields that are intensely fascinating to children.
Correct.
So dinosaurs and space. So why do you think that is?
Big.
Okay.
Big is good.
All right.
I saw that movie.
That's why people love elephants and don't love rats. I do, of course. But
part of me thinks that kids like our respective fields because they respect anything that can eat them. So their favorite dinosaur is going to be T-Rex, and their favorite cosmic object is going to be a black hole. Both of them will eat you.
It's a very depressing view, but I get it.
Kelly, you have any thoughts on that?
Certainly, there's always this curiosity about something, someplace that we want to go. And so space, it's obvious, especially since you can see so much.
Right.
You just go outside.
Right.
And so you can't help but just want to go to a place that you can see and
so just
can't
So would you
reach.
Agree that kids... who don't lose their curiosity as adults are scientists. Or rather, that scientists are kids who never lost their curiosity.
Oh, they're certainly kids. And we're certainly
Ross,
kids that absolutely
you feel
haven't
the same
lost
way?
Their curiosity.
Yeah, I feel like I'm a superannuated kid all the time because I work in a place like
I don't even
the
know
American
what that word
Museum.
Means.
I was going to say, I ain't never heard a kid use the word annuated. Mother, I'm feeling quite annuated right now.
Stick with me, I'll improve your
vocabulary.
No, but you and I do have privileged positions because we work in a place here that is absolutely devoted to understanding the most complicated, the most interesting, the most diverse kinds of phenomena that people have ever dealt with. And that is a beautiful place to be in if you have that kind of attitude where everything is novel, everything is interesting.
Well, Jeff Goldblum, to my surprise, brought a copy of one of my books to the interview. The book he brought was Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
Yes.
And so he asked about my inspiration for writing it. Check it out. It's everything spiritually and intellectually mind-blowing.
Yes.
In the universe that I've collected into that volume.
Yes, and I love your, and because I've heard you on other at other times besides what I think you touch on in this, do we need, in order to be creative, inspired, spiritual, feel grateful, feel uplifted, ennobled, connected with each other, poetical, musical, need we go any further than the facts that have already been uncovered by you and your friends, by science, and what's going on around us? No, of course not. We don't need to make up things or believe in things that are just fun to believe in just because we're lazy and we don't want to kind of investigate a little bit.
I agree with everything you just said, and
well,
I can neither add nor subtract from it.
I love you.
Just some parting thoughts on our show today. Dinosaurs were around for hundreds of millions of years. in some form or another, until all the ones we celebrate, especially the ones with big teeth, all went extinct 65 million years ago. So, in fact, they were around for longer before they went extinct than the time that has elapsed since they went extinct. So, if they didn't go extinct 65 million years ago, there's no reason to think they wouldn't still be here today. But what happened? We fear asteroids, yes. But an asteroid takes out the dinosaurs, pries open an ecological niche, enabling our mammal ancestors to evolve into something somewhat more ambitious than the rodents that they were at the time. So I think about it. Wow. Can asteroids be all that bad? Can extinction be all that bad? We have the technology, we have the intelligence to avoid that fate. We can do better than the hand that nature deals us. We can deflect an asteroid. We can develop a viral serum. We can be good caretakers of the Earth that we are borrowing from our descendants. Until that day comes, our extinction is inevitable. For me, that's a cosmic perspective. I've been your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson. And as always, I bid you to keep looking up.
Spring Black Friday savings are happening now at the Home Depot and also at your front door. Get spring savings delivered to you with free delivery on over 2 million items. Everything you need for spring cleaning, patio decorating, and front yard gardening sent right to you. And if you need it fast, get same day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Spring your way with Spring Black Friday savings only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.